And now, for our feature presentation. Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind. Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone's Talons of Eagles. Narrated by Mort Shelby. With performances by Terence Aselford, Nanette Savard, Richard Rowan, Thomas Penny, Sonny Lasky, Ken Jackson, Casey Jones, Karen Carbone, James Konacek, Dolores King-Williams, Christopher Graybill, Christopher Walker, James Lewis, Tim Carlin, and Chris Rowan.
Jamie Ian McAllister was just a little boy living in the wilderness of Western Ohio when a Shawnee war party killed his family and abducted him. He was adopted into the tribe and learned the warrior's way of the Shawnee. His valor earned him the name Man Who Is Not Afraid. Before his 12th birthday, Jamie escaped from the village, taking with him a young woman named Hannah. The pair made their way to a small pocket of civilization in Kentucky. Jamie was taken into the home of Sam and Sarah Montgomery, while Hannah, who was several years older, was taken in by the preacher and his wife. In that small community, Jamie met Kate Olmsted and fell head over moccasins in love. There was only one hitch. Kate's father and her brother hated Jamie. But that didn't stop the two of them from seeing each other and holding hands whenever they could. When Jamie was 14 years old, he had to kill a man. It was self-defense, but suddenly Jamie found himself a wanted man with a price on his head. He took to the deep woods of Western Kentucky, but wouldn't go far because of his love for Kate. After only a few months, Jamie returned and the two of them eloped. They wandered westward, finally stopping in the big thicket country of East Texas. There they settled in and began to raise a family. New folks moved in and old friends joined them. Jamie became involved with those seeking independence for Texas and joined in the defense of the Alamo. The night before the Alamo fell, he was sent out with a packet of letters from the defenders. He was ambushed and left for dead. He eventually made his way back to his cabin in the big thicket, and in the spring of 1837, Jamie, Kate, and their friends decided to move westward. They settled in a long and lovely valley in Colorado. In the coming years, it would be known as McAllister's Valley. It was there Kate and Jamie's 10th and last child, Falcon, was born in 1839. The name of Jamie McAllister became a legend throughout the West as scout and gunfighter, just as the McAllister children were making names for themselves as they grew into adulthood. Life was good for Jamie and Kate in the Valley, and they were content to watch the town they founded grow and their kids mature and marry and have children of their own. But Jamie McAllister was too famous a man for the public to forget. When he was 50 years old, he received word that President Abe Lincoln wanted to see him. Jamie stayed to himself as much as possible during the train ride eastward, which was not easy since the coaches were filled with blue-uniformed soldiers of the Union Army. To a person, they were convinced the war would not last very long, and they were all anxious to get in it before it was over. Promotions came fast in a war. Jamie was not so sure the war would be a short one, and he was even more baffled as to why the President of the United States wanted him to scout for the Union Army. Jamie knew almost nothing about the country east of the Mississippi, Everything had changed since he'd left that part of the country more than 30 years ago. Jamie stepped out to breathe deeply in the late spring air. He felt strangely torn as a myriad of emotions cut through him. His family, like so many others, had roots in both the North and the South. His mother's side of the family had settled in South Carolina many years before the McAllister clan came to America.
Mind if I join you, sir?
Not at all.
Both pull young soldier boys in there.
Well, they'll soon learn about war.
That they will, friend, that they will. Traveling far?
Not too far.
A sorry thing, this war. After the Union is successful in bringing those damned Southerners to their knees, we should put them on reservations like we're doing with the Indians. Let the damned worthless trash die out.
There's right and wrong on both sides in any war, friend.
Not in this war. No man has the right to hold another as slave.
Well, you're right, slavery is wrong.
Southerners are filthy trash, you agree with that?
No, mister, I don't agree with that.
Can't straddle the fence in this conflict. Now I know what you are.
Oh?
You're a damned filthy secessionist, our intelligence was right.
What the hell are you talking about?
Long live the memory of John Brown!
The man's hand shot under his coat, just as the train began moving through a shady glen. That, coupled with the fast approaching dusk of evening, plunged the train into near darkness. The man whipped out a knife and lunged at Jamie. Jamie clamped one huge hand on the man's wrist and stopped the knife thrust. He hit the man a vicious blow to the jaw with his left fist. The man's eyes glazed over. Jamie twisted the man's knife. Jamie took a step backward for leverage and hurled the man from the platform of the coach. The man bounced and rolled beside the tracks, and then lay still. Whether he was alive or dead, Jamie didn't know and he didn't care. He waited for some sort of outcry from inside, but none came. The sun sank over the horizon, and night covered the land. Jamie stood for several minutes on the platform, deep in thought. Somebody had learned of his invitation to meet with the president. He didn't want him to attend, but why? He hadn't committed to either side in this war, and as it stood now, he probably wouldn't. He had no interest in this war. But if there are any more attempts on his life, he would develop a very personal interest in the conflict. Jamie was met at the Washington train station by one E.J. Allen, who ushered Jamie to a waiting carriage. Jamie made no mention about the attempt on his life. There were some things he wanted to sort out in his head first. E.J. Allen said not a word from the train station to the White House. Jamie could sense that the man either didn't like him, or didn't trust him, or both.
Welcome to the White House, Mr. McAllister. I'll need your pistol and your knife before you can enter.
If you want them, you'll have to take them.
Now listen here, sir.
A tall, almost emaciated-appearing man stepped into the lamp-lit doorway of the mansion.
Let Mr. McAllister be. I'll handle things from here. You may go about your business, Mr. Allen.
Yes, sir, Mr. President, sir.
Inside the White House, Jamie was shown to a private room on the ground floor of the huge three-story mansion and served a hot meal. President Lincoln sat across the table from him, sipping occasionally from a cup of coffee.
Eat, sir, eat. I know you must be ravenous after such a long and tiresome journey. You eat, I'll talk.
Yes, sir.
Is the meal to your liking?
Yes, sir, it's very good.
You're a very famous man, Mr. McAllister.
Jamie, sir, please.
Very well. Jamie it is. Hero of the Alamo, pioneer. Trailblazer and scout. Indian fighter. I've heard the songs about you, read the books and articles, and I saw the play about your life when it played in Springfield. How do you feel about this war that has started?
I don't hold with slavery, sir.
Oh, it isn't just about slavery, although that does play a part in the conflict. It's about, well, whether this nation survives whole or tears itself apart and crumbles.
It looks like to me the tear's already started, sir.
The South can't win, Jamie. It is going to be a very long war, and a costly one in terms of human life. But the South cannot win. We have the factories, the manpower, and the wherewithal to sustain for years. The South simply does not. You could help bring this terrible tragedy to a sooner end, Jamie.
You're asking me to fight against my own son, Mr. President?
Lincoln stood up, almost painfully. Jamie guessed he had bad knees. The president walked around the small meeting room.
I didn't know you had a son fighting for the Confederacy.
Falcon, my youngest. He's 21. And my oldest boy, Jamie Ian, is talking about taking up arms for the Blue. Matt might go with the Blue, too. I don't know, but he's leaning that way. I hope they both stay in Colorado. Andrew's in Europe, and his ma and I wrote him and told him to stay there, stay out of it. My mother's people came from South Carolina, I think. Somewhere in the South. I'm just not sure. I know I feel a great pull toward the Confederacy.
I want you to think about becoming my chief of scouts, Jamie. It would be a great boon to the Union if you would accept the position. If you do not, I will understand.
Well, yes, sir. I promise you I'll think about it.
I have made arrangements for you to stay at a nearby hotel. My carriage driver will take you there. Good luck, and God bless you, Jamie McAllister.
And good luck, and God bless you, sir.
The morning after the meeting with the president, Jamie carefully packed his suit and changed into buckskin. He roamed the city, inspecting several dozen horses before he finally chose one to buy. He bought supplies, a brace of pistols, and a rifle. Then he crossed the Potomac and headed south into Virginia. Just across the river, he stopped and sat for a time under the shade of a huge old tree and read the newspapers he'd bought in Washington. About a third of the experienced Army officers had resigned to take up arms against the Union. Among them were Johnson, Beauregard, and Lee. 1/4 of the experienced naval officers had joined the Confederacy. Lincoln had put out the call for volunteers on April 15, 1861. They'd poured in to join up, hundreds of thousands of them. In contrast, the Confederacy had just less than 60,000 troops active and in training. Jamie looked up from his reading as a troop of cavalrymen, dashing in appearance in their gray and gold uniforms with the officers wearing plumed hats, came galloping up and reined in on the road beside him.
You there, woodsman. You've picked a peculiar place to rest.
Oh? Why's that?
Well, there is a war on, my good fellow. This area could come under attack at any moment.
Not by me. I'm a Western man just passing through. The only thing I know about the war is what I read.
The officer dismounted and handed the reins over to a sergeant.
Rest the men. My friend, you are probably what you say you are, but these are tense times. You run the risk of being arrested as a spy.
I'm no spy, Captain. Although President Lincoln would probably settle for that.
Lincoln?
Yeah, I met with him last evening.
I beg your pardon, sir?
Jamie stood.
I was offered a position in the Union Army. I refused, in a manner of speaking. I have a son who's fighting with a Texas cavalry unit.
Good lad. And your name, sir?
Jamie McAllister.
The Jamie McAllister?
I guess. Far as I know, there's only one of me. I do have a son named Jamie Ian, but he's back in Colorado.
And how was Mr. Lincoln, sir?
Saddened by the war.
He has no need to be. He has only to give us independence and there will be no war.
Well, he won't do that, sir.
No, I'm sure he won't. You have heard the Yankee side, sir. Would you be interested in hearing our side of the issue?
I would.
I am Captain Court Woodville, sir, of the Virginia Scouts. There is someone I would very much like you to meet.
Kate was sitting on the front porch with Ellen Kathleen, Megan, Jolene, and Jamie Ian's wife, Caroline. The ladies were rocking and talking and sewing.
Jamie Ian's going off to war, Ma.
Oh? He tell you that, Caroline?
No, Ma, but I can see it in him.
Matthew is going to resign his commission as sheriff and join up with the Blue. And yes, he told me. He was scared to confront you himself, Ma.
And so far, we'll have two for the Blue, two for the Gray.
Who besides Falcon, Ma?
Your father, Jolene.
Pa don't hold with slavery, Ma.
No, but he'll almost always take up for the underdog. Did any of you know that Wells and Robert rode out yesterday? We're going to be short of men folks for a time.
Wells and Robert, but...
They've gone to join up with a Negro army somewhere back east. Certainly no one can blame them. If Titus and Moses weren't so old, they would have gone too. But the boys talked them out of it.
Pa ain't no spring chicken.
Isn't, Ellen Kathleen. Oh, he's still got some spry in him.
I just can't believe that Paul would take up with the gray.
Your father will do what he thinks is right. I think he suspected all along that this valley would be split between the blue and the gray. There will be others who answer the call. Hannon Swede's oldest boy might go. Juan has sons that were born in Texas, remember? Sam and Sarah's oldest boy might go, too. Some will not return.
General Robert E. Lee, Mr. Jamie McAllister.
The two men shook hands. It was full dark outside, for Lee had been camped a half day's ride from where Jamie had been found. Jamie noticed that Lee's eyes held the same sadness and sorrow that he had seen in President Lincoln's eyes.
Please, have a seat. You stay, Captain Woodville. I don't suppose Abe Lincoln told you about any upcoming battle plans, did he, Mr. McAllister?
No. He just wanted me to take over as Chief of Scouts for the Union Army. I promised him I'd think about it, but I believe he knows that I will not accept the position.
Then throw your lot in with us, sir. If you don't, you'll be missing a grand fight. Of course, it will be a short one.
It will be a long and bloody war, Captain Woodville. It will be brother against brother, father against son. I suspect its duration and human cost will make the Revolutionary War and the War of 1812 pale by comparison. But, sadly, it is a war that has to be.
Explain that to me, General Lee. A war that has to be.
If the Yankees win this war, McAllister, it will signal the beginning of the end of many personal rights and liberties that will affect every citizen of the United States. Government is a dangerous thing. Compare it to fire, a useful servant, a fearsome master. If we allow the North to win, it will be the end to states' rights. The citizens of any state will no longer rule their lives. The federal government will. Governors will be figureheads only. They will be allowed to make very minor decisions, but the major ones will have to have the blessings of the federal government. And that is no way for good, decent, free men and women to live.
What about slavery?
It should have ended a long time ago. Should never have started. I'm on record as being a disbeliever in slavery and secession.
How could I be of service to you, General Lee?
I feel confident that we could find a place for you, Mr. McAllister.
The final day of peace had passed on April 11th. On the 12th, Confederate forces had fired on Fort Sumter. At that time, the stars in the Confederate flag formed a circle of seven on a blue background. For only seven states had seceded up to that point: South Carolina, Mississippi, Florida, Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana, and Texas. Four other states would quickly follow: Virginia, Arkansas, Tennessee, and North Carolina. Matthew and Jamie Ian had left McAllister's Valley to join with the Union forces. Falcon McAllister was now a lieutenant, leading a band of Texas Rangers and waging a guerrilla war against the Union forces. Two of Juan Nunez's sons had joined the Confederacy in Texas. Wells and Robert had joined the Union's Negro Army, now being formed and trained in New Jersey. Swede and Hannah's oldest son and Sam and Sarah's son had joined the Union forces of Iowa. The citizens of McAllister's Valley were quickly choosing sides.
I don't think the Yankees will ever get as far as Richmond. I think we'll start them cold long before then. But Lee wants us to see the country, so I'll take this time to show you Ravenswood and introduce you to my wife. We'll have some real home cooking and sleep in a warm bed this evening.
Sounds good to me. You have children, Court?
One, a daughter, Paige. Her mother is sending her to a finishing school. This is Ravenswood, Jamie. For as far as you can see in any direction. I have slaves, but they are not mistreated. I won't allow that, neither would my father. They work hard if they're able, but they are well fed, housed adequately, and receive some medical care.
Ann Woodville almost died when she looked out the window of her upstairs sitting room and saw Jamie Ian McAllister riding up with Court. Although it had been many years since she and her brother had left the valley in Colorado and changed their names, there was no mistaking Jamie. Thank God Paige was in Richmond. She wondered if Jamie would spill the beans. Not that there were that many beans left to spill. Court knew much of the sordid story, having learned some of it from Ann's brother, the rest from Ann herself. But to make matters worse, her brother Ross had fathered a child in the past year during one of his rare couplings with a woman in Richmond. Worse still, the woman was a lady of quality from an old Virginia family. But her brother had done the right thing and married the woman, although his sexual leaning certainly went the other way. Now there were two more unhappy people added to the list, and a child that was a quarter black but looked white. Anne felt there could be no hell after life. This was hell right here on earth. Being a gracious lady of the South, although if her background were really known, the good ladies of Richmond society would all suddenly develop the vapors and fall over in a dead faint. Anne walked down the curving steps of the mansion and out onto the porch to greet her husband and his guests.
Court, darling, what a delightful surprise.
Jamie recognized Anne immediately, but he didn't so much as blink an eye in recognition.
Mrs. Woodville, your husband said you were lovely, but his words didn't do you justice.
Why, sir, you are just too kind.
Stable boy, I need a fresh horse saddled. I must go into town for a few hours. You will, of course, stay here. I'll be back in time for drinks and supper. Everything all right, Anne?
Everything's fine.
All right, then. I'll be off. See you later.
Come inside, please. Will you have a drink, Mr. McAllister?
Water would be nice, Mrs. Woodville. You really must have been a fine actress.
Oh, I was. Please sit. Selma, water, please. Leave us for a time, Selma. I'll ring if I need you.
Yes'm.
You're a fine actor yourself, Jamie. That was quite a performance you just put on.
I'm not here to interfere in your life, Anne. I didn't know you were Court's wife.
Thank you. But there are no secrets left between us. Court knows all about me. I made sure of that. Well, he doesn't know that I know you and Kate. Oh, he wouldn't dare divorce me. I could ruin his reputation. He and my brother are lovers.
What? I don't believe it.
Why would I lie? I don't mean to impugn his bravery, for Court is a very brave man. One of the first to volunteer for the Grey. It's just, well, these things happen.
Well, does he know that you...
That I know? Certainly. What it means is that neither of us shall ever ask the other for a divorce. He will be discreet, and so will I.
With your,
Our lovers, yes.
Just the one child, Anne?
No. Paige has a twin brother. He isn't black, but neither is he white. That's very plain. I never held him. He was given to a woman in the slave quarters who lost a child, and some years later when he was, I don't know, time goes by so swiftly. Anyway, he was sent north on the Underground Railroad. I don't know where he is or what he looks like or even if he made it across the line to freedom.
You ever think about him?
Yes. Not as often now as I used to, but yes, I do think about him. Oh, I should write my memoirs and have them published. I could make a fortune, but then I'm already worth several fortunes.
You'd better invest in something outside of the South, Anne.
Oh, but I have. I have this clever little man in Richmond who has been secretly investing sums of my money in factories up north. I own a factory that makes uniforms, another that makes guns, and yet another that manufactures boots and shoes. And I own bits and pieces of several other factories, all located far above the Mason-Dixon line. You believe the South will lose this war, Jamie?
Yeah. After several long and bloody years, the North has the manpower, the money, and the factories.
And yet you choose to fight for the South?
The federal government does not have the right to tell individual states what they can or cannot do. That is really what this war is all about, control of our lives. If I obey the laws of God and observe a moral code here on earth, the government has no business interfering in my life.
And your sons?
Falcon is fighting for the Grey in Texas. I suspect Jamie Ian will choose the side of the Blue, and so will Matthew.
Father against son.
The next morning, over breakfast, Court Woodville made a surprise announcement.
I've been what?
You've been commissioned a major in the Army of the Confederacy, sir.
By whose orders?
General Lee, Major. You are to assume command immediately of 2 companies of Confederate guerrillas and commence harassing the enemy, sir. General Lee telegraphed all his commanding officers that could be handily reached by wire, seeking their opinion on your commission, and I am proud to say that returning word was unanimously in favor.
Well, I'll just be damned. I beg your pardon, Mrs. Woodville.
General Lee predicted that 3 days from now, when I am to ride with you to a staging area about 30 miles from here, volunteers would be lined up 50 deep and an acre across to join you, Major.
I've never commanded men before.
You just thought you weren't commanding the Major, but they were following you.
Men, I'm seeking volunteers. I want men who can ride like the wind, shoot like Davy Crockett, and possess the courage to charge the gates of hell at my command.
The entire group of men stepped forward. Jamie was stunned at the size of the contingent that had volunteered to ride with his command. Hundreds of men had arrived at the staging area in hopes of being chosen to ride with McAllister's Marauders. That name not of Jamie's choosing, but of Court's. Jamie had read over the records of the officers who had volunteered and chose Captain Jim Sparks from Texas as commanding officer of 1st Company and Captain Pierre Dupree of Louisiana as commanding officer of the 2nd Company. As his command sergeant major, he chose an Alabama man, a career soldier who had left the federal forces after years of brave and loyal service to fight for his homeland, Louis Husky. Each company would be comprised of 103 men and officers. They would carry only light rations, depending for the most part on the goodwill and generosity of the people of the South for food. Each man would carry 4 pistols, 2 on their person and 2 on special-made saddle holsters, 1 left and right, butt facing to the rear. And each man would carry 1 Sharps 54 caliber carbine. Court tried to persuade Jamie to add sabers to the list of weapons. Jamie stood his ground against them. He would equip each marauder with a long, bladed bowie knife. The officers could carry sabers if they chose to do so, and they all did. But the rest of Jamie's men would carry bowie knives. Before any further men were chosen, Jamie personally selected the horses. He would have preferred the tough mountain horses that he knew and loved, but Mustangs were impossible to find in Virginia. The horses he chose were not the prettiest of the lot. They were tough and strong. He chose no animal that he knew had been raised on grain, for grain was something that was going to be hard to come by. The color of the horses was also very important, for he wanted no horse that would stand out day or night. And finally, since they were to be guerrillas, Jamie was adamant about uniforms. There were to be no military uniforms worn in his unit. Lee and J.E.B. Stewart watched Jamie closely that first day and part of the second. By then, they knew they couldn't have picked a better man to command the guerrillas. Jamie McAllister had proven himself in battle dozens of times over the years, and he had the unwavering loyalty and respect of the men. Lee and Stewart summoned Jamie to a meeting at the close of his second day at the staging area. Robert E. Lee moved his finger along a map spread out on a table. His finger left that position and moved along another line.
Jamie, the Army of the Shenandoah is ready. General Johnson has just over 10,000 men, trained and ready to fight. There, here. Up here and over here, under the command of General Robert Patterson, are the Union forces, some 20,000 of them. Patterson is a fine man, but he's too old and much too timid for a field command. General Winfield Scott made a blunder by appointing him to command the Union forces now preparing to advance on Harper's Ferry. Scott will soon discover his mistake, but it will be too late. Begin training your marauders hard, Major, for I am going to thrust you all into the lion's mouth very soon. You and your marauders are going to cross the river and begin harassing actions against Patterson's green and unproven troops. I want you to convince Patterson that he has many more men attacking him than he does in truth. Buy us some time, Major. For God's sake and the sake of the Confederacy, buy us some time.
I'll do my best, sir.
I know you will. Here's the reason for your daring actions. General Irvin McDowell is training thousands of troops to add to Patterson's force. General Beauregard's troops will be shifted over here to add to our forces. It is going to be a great battle, Major. One that we can win if we play our cards close to the vest. Johnson is going to let Patterson think he has him on the run. As Patterson advances, Johnson is going to retreat from Harper's Ferry, pulling the Yankees deeper into the trap. The Yankees may or may not fall for the trap. I suspect they will sense something is wrong and quickly turn around and head back across the Potomac. If that is the case, we put another plan into action.
What does intelligence say about McDowell's force over here on this flank?
Many of them are green troops or old inactive veterans, poorly trained and poorly equipped. They're short on supplies and short on weapons and ammunition.
And the major offensive is scheduled to begin when?
As near as our spies can pinpoint it, the date will be July 8th. We'll be ready by that time. McDowell's troops will not be ready. We will, in all probability, be facing the largest army ever assembled in North America. Probably more than 35,000 men.
Now this place here, what's this called?
Bull Run.
Jamie began pushing his men hard. What he had to do was knock all sense of fair play out of them, and then start from the ground up retraining them in guerrilla warfare. To a man, they knew that Jamie McAllister had been raised by Shawnee Indians and was a master at what was called dirty fighting. To Jamie's mind, that was nonsense. There was no such thing as a fair fight. There was a winner, and there was a loser, and that was all. In war, you killed the enemy, and that was that. His two companies were chosen, and he had personally hand-picked 50 men to stand in reserve, for only a fool didn't expect casualties. Jamie adopted little of the established cavalry tactics. Other people could fight gentlemen's wars. Despite all the talk of how he was to disrupt supply lines and create confusion among the enemy, Jamie knew he and his men had really but one function, to kill as many of the enemy as possible. Jamie put aside his buckskins and dressed like his men in civilian clothing, but he still wore his moccasins and high leggings. The horse he had chosen for himself was a monster, a mean-eyed, dark, sand-colored brute named Satan, whose owner had been threatening to shoot when Jamie arrived at the farm. Within a week, Satan was eating out of Jamie's hand and following him around like a trained dog. Soon, Jamie and his marauders were riding toward the north. Jamie broke his command up into small groups so as not to arouse suspicion among the federal spies who seemed to be everywhere. Jamie's aide was a young Virginia lad, not yet out of his teen years, Private Benjamin Pardee. He had picked Ben for several reasons. Ben was small and light in weight, he could ride like the wind. Jamie's marauders began gathering in four places just south of the Potomac River. Across the river, clearly visible to the naked eye, were the campfires of the Federals. Although President Davis and General Lee had forbid General P.G.T. Beauregard from taking any type of offensive action against the Yankees, that order did not apply to McAllister's marauders. On this night, the marauders would not attack in force. Jamie had other plans. Captain Sparks was an experienced Indian fighter with years of fighting Comanches and Apaches behind him, and so was Lieutenant Castle. Jamie chose nine other men with experience fighting Indians, and at full dark, they left their horses on the south side of the river and rode across the river, using boats that had been hidden in the brush the day before. Jamie and his men were armed only with pistols and knives and packets of explosives. The green troops of General McDowell were about to experience the terror of sneak attack by men who had learned it firsthand from the greatest guerrilla fighters the world had ever known, the Indians. Jamie took Casson and three enlisted men and circled the camp to his left, while Sparks took the remainder and went to his right. Sparks knew what to do, for this had been researched several times, using information supplied to Jamie from Confederate spies. Jamie placed his black powder charges gently, choosing his spots with care. One smaller charge went between two senior officers' tents. another huge charge was planted behind the rough-built powder house. The men with Jamie and Sparks planted small charges around artillery pieces. When that was done, they backed off just inside good pistol range and waited for Jamie's signal. Then they lit the fuses and slipped away to lie belly down in good pistol range of the camp without being detected. Four senior officers were killed instantly by the charge that Jamie had planted between the tents, and several more were badly wounded. When the blockhouse went up, it leveled everything within a 500-foot radius. The charges under the artillery pieces went off. For some inexplicable reason known only to God and the inexperienced artillery crews, the cannons were fully charged and ready to fire. Sparks from the exploding charges ignited the power in the fire holes, and the cannons began going off. Since many had wheels blown off of them, balls went ripping off at ground level, doing terrible damage to tents, wagons, and people. The men of McAllister's Marauders let their pistols bang into the running, milling, confused mass of Federal troops. When their pistols were empty, they headed for the river, the boats. They didn't attempt to row, just lay flat on the bottom, and let the current move them along downriver until the gloom of the cloudy night swamped. Northern newspapers put out special editions with huge headlines. A cowardly act, vicious sneak attack, and thugs attack sleeping Union camp. The strategists in the Confederate camp decided it would be a good thing to just let a bit of news leak out about McAllister's Marauders and the actual number of men who had attacked the Union encampment. It was said that General Winfield Scott went into a rage upon hearing that only 10 or so men were responsible for the terrible damage that was wreaked upon McDowell's camp along the Potomac. Most northern newspapers called the number false. Several Union generals loudly proclaimed that 10 hound dog Southerners couldn't inflict that much damage on a northern church choir, much less upon an armed camp. One of those generals was Thomas Thornberry, a pompous, lard butt loudmouth who commanded a Pennsylvania home guard. Thornberry, who came from a very wealthy Philadelphia family, had commanded his small militia for years, and his rank was self-imposed. He had never experienced actual combat. But he did make good copy for the newspapers, because he always had something outrageous to say. This time, Thornberry was quoted as saying, "If those yellow-bellied southern riffraff ever come to Pennsylvania, I'll personally kick their ignorant butts back across the Mason-Dixon line." Jamie read with interest the remarks of General Thornberry. Then he sat in his tent for a time, deep in thought, a smile occasionally playing across his mouth. Without telling anyone what he had planned, Jamie met with Captain Sparks and Dupree, and in twos and threes, the Marauders began quietly saddling up and riding out. Jamie took scissors and cut his long hair short, dyed what remained black, and laid out his good dark suit. Jamie left Satan and rode out of camp on a horse that had been deemed unfit as a cavalry mount. He turned it loose once he got past enemy lines into a train depot, and then he headed north. His hand-picked men were already well on their way, posing as drummers, wandering itinerant laborers, and so forth. Jamie figured if he could successfully pull this off, he and his men would really tweak the noses of the Yankees. Safely past Yankee lines, Jamie turned his horse loose and bought a train ticket for Philadelphia. There were several of his own men on the same train. They didn't speak to one another, and they managed to find seats in different cars. Having initially ridden the steam cars much of the way to Washington to meet with Abe Lincoln, Jamie had gotten used to the railroads, but it still bothered him somewhat to be speeding along that fast. Jamie got himself a room in a run-down boarding house on the seedy side of town, as did his men. He bought a horse and arranged for other horses at various stables and liveries around the city. Thomas Thornberry lived a few miles outside the city, in a large home on several hundred acres of land. He had never married, and rumor had it that he enjoyed the company of whores several nights a month, usually three or more of the soiled doves at a time. Jamie made friends with several working prostitutes, and after buying the ladies several bottles and getting them drunk, he learned a great deal about Thornberry and his home guard. Thornberry was a man who liked his food, and especially his strong drink. As more than one of the ladies had told Jamie with a wink, Thomas Thornberry was a bit peculiar when he entertained the ladies. And each morning, when it wasn't raining, Thornberry hoisted the American flag on a pole outside his mansion. Jamie figured if they hit Thornberry's house at 10 or so in the evening and did whatever they intended to do, they might have 6 hours at the most before Thornberry and the whores worked themselves loose and sounded the alarm. So the escape route had to be as foolproof as possible. And Jamie didn't want to hurt Thornberry, and certainly not the women. He just wanted to show the Yankees that they were not as safe in their homes far north of the war as they might think. On the evening of the attack, there was certainly going to be a flag raised, but it damn sure wasn't going to be the stars and stripes that would be fluttering proudly in the morning's breeze come sunup. Jamie and his men had brought with them a dozen Confederate battle flags. And come the dawning, the stars and bars would be flying in certain spots all over the city. Sparks had carefully reconnoitered the home guard's armory and was busy working out a plan to blow that up in order to create a diversion just as the marauders slipped out of the city. When the deed was done, the marauders were going to scatter in all directions. Jamie had paid for a week's lodging in advance. On the night of the attack, he dropped his bedroll and saddlebags out of the window to one of his men waiting below. Then he walked down the steps and strolled out the front as if he were simply going out for a bite to eat and some drinks at a local tavern. Jamie walked around the block to where his man was waiting with their horses.
The rest of the men, Sergeant McGuire?
On their way, Major.
Let's do it.
The two walked their horses until they were a mile out of town, where they met up with several more marauders. 15 of Jamie's men remained in town, each with a different assignment. Jamie linked up with his group in a stand of timber about a half a mile from the Thornberry Mansion, and they waited for a time. Jamie opened his pocket watch, a present from Kate with her picture inside the cover, and checked the time. They had 1 hour to do the deed, for at midnight, all hell was about to break loose in various parts of the city.
Party, stay with the horses and keep them quiet.
Jamie and his band made their way silently toward General Thornberry's great house.
Do make a darling lassie.
Dupree and Jamie exchanged quick glances. Jamie smiled and motioned McGuire on ahead to check out the house.
When the blackbird in the spring on the willow tree.
You boys have got to see this to believe it. The general's all dolled up in a dress.
And the ladies, two of them as naked as jaybirds, and the third one ain't far behind. The general sure likes his ladies on the hefty side.
Perfect. Let's go.
Jamie felt sure the general would not risk having his antics observed by any guards. The lock on the back door was Jimmy, and the men silently entered the house and made their way to the huge room located in the center of the mansion. Jamie stood in the shadows just inside the archway. Watch the goings on for a moment. General Thomas Thornberry was all dressed up in an evening gown, complete with gloves and a hat. He was dancing with one of the naked prostitutes.
Don't stop! We're just getting to the good part!
The good part's over.
Get out of my house, goddamn you!
Isn't he cute?
Who are you men?
Some of those yellow-bellied southern riffraff you talked about, General Thornberry. We came to pay you a little visit. My, don't you look military.
Get out of my house!
Secure them, just as they are. Throw some logs on the fire. We wouldn't want any of these ladies to catch cold now, would we?
Come on, ladies, not gonna hurt you. Just gonna tie you up.
Don't bother me none. I've been tied up plenty.
Who are you, sir?
Major Jamie Ian McAllister, the Army of the Confederate States of America. We are the Marauders, General, and you Yankees have not heard the last from us. Now I'll give you a word of advice, sir. There are good men on both sides of this struggle. The next time you want to question the courage of those who chose to wear the gray, don't. Good night, General R.L.A. Pleasant dreams now, you hear?
Back outside, Jamie unfurled the Confederate battle flag and ran it up the flagpole in front of the house. Jamie stood for a moment, looking up and grinning. Then he and his men faded into the night. In Philadelphia, in the Home Guard's armory, the explosives had been planted, and the men waited, one occasionally checking his pocket watch. At the shipyards, marauders had swum out to naval ships in the harbor and planted explosives, while others of the band of guerrillas had placed explosives on ships under construction in the yard. When the Home Guard's armory blew, it shook that entire end of the city, sending flames shooting high into the night skies and scaring the daylights out of the citizens of the city who lived near there. Thomas Thornberry had been stockpiling arms and powder for months. And there was enough ordnance in the warehouses to outfit an entire division for a long campaign. Then the shipyard went up. One ship was totally destroyed, two others partially sunk, several others badly damaged. The actual damage inflicted upon the Union cause by McAllister's marauders was really not all that great once the dawning came and things began settling down. But it was a terrible blow to Yankee pride, which was exactly what Jamie had wanted. The editor of the newspaper did send a reporter out to the Thornberry mansion. Unfortunately for General Thornberry, the reporter took his wife out there with him. No story was ever written about the general's strange attire, or if it was never printed. But following the marauders' attack upon the city of Philadelphia, Thomas Thornberry did retire his commission and step down as commanding general of the Home Guard. In a public statement, he said it was time for a younger man to take over. Thomas Thornberry dropped out of the public's eye and never made another comment about the bravery and courage of the Southern fighting man. Two of the ladies who were found with General Thornberry immediately retired from prostitution to the absolute amazement of their friends and opened successful businesses of their own in the city. Now, where they got the money to do all this remained forever a mystery. The third soiled dove, who was approximately the same girth as the general, married Thomas Thornberry in a private ceremony, and the two just dropped out of sight. A dress shop was kept busy for years making dresses in duplicate. Jamie and his men returned to a hero's welcome at the encampment. Even Generals Lee and Johnston were all smiles when they greeted Jamie. Johnston had accommodation for him from President Davis.
You struck a mighty blow for the South, Major. But as soon as you and your men get some rest, I want you to ride north and join up with Beauregard up between Centerville and Manassas on the south bank of Bull Run. General Beauregard will have orders for you when you get there. Good luck and good hunting.
When Jamie reached the area, he did not immediately report to General Beauregard. Instead, he spent several hours riding back and forth over as much of the area as he could, talking with rebel troops. Jamie didn't know much about commanding huge armies, but he did know guerrilla tactics. In his mind, he wondered if the Yankees had any outfit such as his own. If the Union Army had men such as those Jamie commanded, he saw a flaw in Beauregard's positioning of troops, for the general was so sure the Union forces would attack across Mitchell's Ford that he had spread too few troops on the left side of his lines. Jamie understood why the general had done that, for the left side of the line consisted of either thick, almost impenetrable woods or narrow, twisting roads that no advancing army of any size could use with any speed. Jamie had to hide his smile when he reported to Beauregard, for the general wasted no time, and in short order, Jamie was congratulated and then given his orders.
I want you and your marauders on this side of my line, Major, right here at Sudley Ford. But you are not confined to that area alone. Go where you're needed. And a man of your many talents will surely be needed, I assure you that.
I'll get settled in then, General Beauregard, and get my men in position.
Oh, Major, we'll probably be falling back some few thousand yards. Be prepared to move out hurriedly.
Yes, sir. I was briefed down south.
I assumed as much, but I wanted to be sure.
It was July 16th. Beauregard's army stretched for more than 6 miles along Bull Run.
the Confederate government in Richmond had expressly forbidden Beauregard from taking any type of offensive action. And after seeing that the rebels were not going to bring the fight to them, the Yankees began a slow advance toward rebel positions. They had no way of knowing that it was a trap, but when the Federal troops had advanced far enough, Beauregard's plan was to flank them and cut them off from the nation's capital. The Yankees' advance was slowed to a snail's pace in the sparsely populated area, filled with thick brush, dense forest, and creek bottoms that seemed to swallow the wagons up to their axles. Many of the Federal troops became separated from their units and got lost. Jamie's men captured more than 24 of them, and they were disarmed and brought to Jamie.
Oh, look at them, Dupree. They're scared boys. They should be playing games and sparking young girls.
Jamie walked the short line, eyeballing each prisoner for a few seconds. The imposing figure of Jamie McAllister stalking up and down to in front of him caused many of the soldiers to tremble in their hot and ill-fitting uniforms. Jamie wore his customary black shirt and gray breeches, a yellow kerchief tied around his neck. With his moccasins and high leggings, deeply tanned face and muscular build, he looked like some sort of pirate to the young men. They didn't know who the hell had captured him. He ordered the young soldiers to be taken to Beauregard's HQ for questioning, and then settled down to wait for some action. But none came that night, and the marauders all got a good night's sleep. Mid-morning of the 17th, a runner found Dupree and told him to fall back. Union troops were only a half a mile from Fairfax Courthouse.
The Yankees are taking the bait, Major McAllister. It won't be long now. Beauregard set the Orange and Alexandria Railroad Bridge on fire.
This may work after all. Let's fall back, Dupree.
Beauregard had given orders to his troops at Fairfax Courthouse to leave food still cooking on the fires, giving the Yankees the impression they were so frightened they had fled without eating. The Union soldiers were jubilant. They ate the hot food and sang victorious songs with their coffee. But their jubilation was to be short-lived. The Union General McDowell was giving conflicting orders to his commanders and being forced to rethink his strategy every hour or so. Nothing was working out as he had planned. He had reached Fairfax Courthouse expecting to find another of his generals, Heintzelman, waiting for him. But now he had no idea where General Heintzelman might be. Heintzelman and his men had been slowed down to a crawl by the dense brush and poor roads. McDowell was also beginning to suspect a trap. He had just learned that Centerville had been abandoned by the rebels, and also that all along the rebel line the Confederates were pulling back. That seemed very odd to him. McDowell ordered another of his generals, Dan Tyler, to ride through Centerville at first light to check out the situation. And McDowell also gave him firm orders not to engage the enemy. Just check it out and report back with his findings. Jamie and his two companies of marauders had pulled back as ordered and were cooling their heels in the dense timber, hoping to see a blue coat to shoot at. So far, they had seen nothing, nor had they heard the first shot. A runner found Jamie and handed him orders. Jamie was to take his marauders over to a stand of timber not far from Mitchell's Ford and throw up a line. Beauregard suspected something was up. Just moments after Jamie and his marauders got into place, after having circled wide and come up from the south, Tyler exceeded his orders and he decided to take the town of Manassas. His thinking was that since the rebels seemed to be in full retreat, why not take advantage of it and forge on ahead? It would be quite a feather in his cap. Tyler gave orders to send several companies of the 1st Massachusetts forward, and at the same time ordered several 20-pounders to open fire, where he suspected rebel artillery to be hidden in the thickets. He also ordered two other companies of infantry to seize and hold a wooded area that lay off some distance from the suspected rebel artillery battery. He had no way of knowing that Jamie and his men were in those woods waiting. The batteries commenced firing as the two companies began advancing on the hidden positions of the marauders.
Open her up!
12 rebel riflemen fired. 10 Union soldiers went down, 4 of them dead and the others badly wounded. Tyler took to the timber, confusion in his glance. Then his gaze was averted as the 1st Massachusetts came under heavy fire from rebel snipers far to the right side of Jamie's position. Tyler not only ignored his orders, but threw all caution to the wind.
Take the rebel positions!
But Tyler's men were caught in a heavy crossfire and pinned down. Tyler called for his entire command, just over a brigade strong, to come up.
Advance!
Tyler ordered another line set up, facing Jamie and his men, but his only option was to place him on the crest of a hill. After a few minutes of deadly fire from the Marauder snipers, he realized his folly.
Withdraw!
In a desperate move, General Tyler placed men from the 12th New York, the 1st Massachusetts, and the 2nd and 3rd Michigan stretched out along a line facing the rebels. They couldn't advance. After less than half an hour of fierce fighting, Tyler again backed off.
Withdraw! Where it? How many do you figure in the stand?
No way of knowing, sir.
Take your men against Longstreet's brigade. Break through.
Yes, sir!
The weakest point of the miles-long line was at Blackburn's Fort, and that was due to terrain, not the resolve of the Southerners under the command of Longstreet. Now General Tyler was faced with some tough decisions. He had no way of knowing that Jamie's Marauders were only two companies strong, without a single cannon to back them. Had he taken a chance, he might have broken through and begun a flanking move, but he did not. He elected to pull back to 12th New York and send them directly at Longstreet's men. But Beauregard had sent Early's brigade to beef up Longstreet and went there himself with his men. He and Longstreet stood up behind their troops, sabers in hand, the sight of them braving the bullets only adding to the courage of their men. After only 20 minutes, the 12th New York began to retreat, and it was not an orderly withdrawal, it was a rout. That retreat left other Union troops under Tyler's command wide open, and Longstreet sent men from his Virginia command across the stream.
Charge! Break the line, boys!
The Union line broke, and the troops began running toward the rear. Longstreet didn't pursue, a decision that was questioned for some time by other Confederate officers. Instead, he ordered his rebels back and to resume their position south of the creek. The battle for Blackburn's Ford was over, with the rebels clearly victorious. For the next several days, all was mostly quiet along the long lines. Jamie and his men held their positions in the woods and rested, wrote letters home, talked amongst themselves. The men of the Marauders were gradually adopting a battle dress, and Jamie didn't object. While Jamie wore a black shirt and gray trousers, the men were now nearly all wearing gray shirts and black trousers. All now wore the yellow bandana around their throats and the standard Confederate cavalryman's hat. Dupree's wife had gathered together several Louisiana ladies and sewed a battle flag for the Marauders. Jamie smiled when he saw it, but offered no objections to its use. As a matter of fact, he was rather amused by it. It was a black flag with a pirate skull and crossbones in the center. Leaving his two companies resting in the woods, Jamie rode over to Beauregard's headquarters. His aide, Little Ben Pardee, rode with him. General Joseph E. Johnston was there. Johnston, being the senior officer, was in command of the entire rebel army. But for the Battle of Manassas, the Yankees called it Bull Run, he left Beauregard in complete command. It was the 20th of July, 1861. Reinforcements were arriving almost hourly. General T.J. Jackson and his Virginia Brigade had arrived, as had General B.E.B. from South Carolina, and General E.K. Smith and his men. General Theophilus Holmes had arrived with his troops, as had Colonel Hampton and his South Carolina Hampton Legion, and Colonel Bartow's Georgia Brigade. Many had their own flags, and it was getting confusing, for the flags were all different, some of them not even using the Confederate colors. In addition to the thousands of Confederate troops already gathered, by July 21st, more than 9,000 other rebels had made the trip by railroad to beef up the Confederate Army. At the same time, the Union forces were also being increased. By reporters and civilian well-wishers who came bringing picnic lunches and kegs of beer and stronger spirits. They pitched tents and laid down blankets and cots. They came by the hundreds, getting in the way and in general making a nuisance of themselves. They were in high spirits, some having traveled long distances to witness firsthand the Union Army give the Confederate Army a good sound licking and teach these upstart Southerners a lesson. They settled in under whatever shade they could find and uncorked their spy glasses and field glasses and got ready to have a party after the battle. One of Jamie's men would live for a time in Ohio,
did not have a pronounced southern drawl, slipped into Yankee-held territory and mingled with the crowds for a day before slipping back across the lines at night.
Must be nearabouts 1,000 civilians over there, Major. A man named Matt Brady is over there with his cameras, and there are congressmen and senators from Washington, D.C. there. And they got troops coming in, just like we have.
Civilians? Why?
To watch the Yankees whip us, sir.
They're in for a disappointment.
Major McAllister, General Johnston has orders for you. When the battle starts in earnest, he wants you and your men to cross the stream and launch a flanking action that will create a lot of confusion.
Well, we do that right well.
Yes, we know.
Long after the aide had left, Jamie studied the crude maps and the overall battle plan carefully, and again immediately picked up the flaws in it. The northwest, or left side of the line, was grossly undermanned. Beauregard had placed the bulk of his troops far to the right, down around Mitchell's Ford, Blackburn's Ford, and McLean's Ford, leaving the left side of the line very nearly wide open. Jamie wasn't about to openly question the commanding general on his battle tactics. However, he could see to it that the Union forces he was to face in a few hours would think they were up against a much larger force.
Major McAllister! Major McAllister!
Jamie was awakened at 3 o'clock on the morning of July 21st by a runner. Pulling on his moccasins and tying his leggings, Jamie looked at the young man.
The Yankees are on the move, sir. They were rousted out about an hour ago. Them that could sleep, that is. Our people in the observation post say the Yankees hardly slept at all.
And you, son?
I ain't slept none, Major. War's in the air, I reckon.
I reckon.
The marauders were roused. They drank coffee and ate cold biscuits, then saddled up. With Jamie in the lead, they moved silently through the brush and timber over to Colonel Evans' position between Young's Branch and the stream called Bull Run. Jamie and Evans shook hands.
Your orders, Major?
To raise some hell with the Yankees, Colonel Evans. I figure they'll hit us at dawn.
If they can ever get into position. My forward people report a lot of confusion and cussing over there.
Evans was right about that. The terrain was totally unfamiliar to the Union troops, and many were stumbling around, tripping over things, and falling down. The rattle of Yankee equipment clattering against rocks and such was enough to raise the dead. The rebels waited behind their guns, silent in the gloom of night. At dawn, Jamie had moved his people several hundred yards away from Evans' position, and he was keeping them hidden in a stand of brush and timber. Nothing was happening down the line, and Jamie felt a sinking feeling in the pit of his stomach. He had a strong suspicion that the whole of the Union Army was going to come pouring right over and through his and Evans' men. Just a few minutes after 7 that morning, Colonel Evans sent his runner over to Jamie.
The colonel thinks the Yankees are bluffing. They ain't going to attack in strength along our positions. He thinks they're going to strike at Sudley Ford. That's Burnside's Yankees. The colonel wants you and your people over there. He'll join you as quickly as possible.
Jamie quickly shifted his marauders over to the left, and they waited. Just a few minutes later, he saw the glint of Union bayonets flashing in the morning sun as the first troops moved into position in the trees around Sudley Ford. Jamie sent Ben Pardee on the fly to tell Evans of the news. Evans quickly shifted his command around, putting Major Weed and his red-shifted 500-man Louisiana Tigers just to Jamie's right. Weed's Tigers were a unit known for its bravery under fire. Jamie rode over to meet Weed. He could look Weed straight in the eye, for both men were over 6 feet 4 inches tall, although Weed outweighed Jamie's 225 pounds by a good 75 pounds. Major Robidoux Weed was a very imposing figure of a man.
We're slightly outnumbered down here, McAllister.
I'd say about 25 to 1, but I have a plan.
Oh?
We'll charge.
You're damn right we will. I'll get my boys ready and wait for your signal.
Jamie returned to his marauders and told him what he planned to do. His men grinned at him. Jamie, at the far end of the left side, watched for a time longer and then sent Ben Pardee racing back to Evans.
We're being flanked, sir. Just north of the stone bridge.
What's Major McAllister going to do?
Well, us and Major Weed is fixing to charge, sir.
That just might be a pretty good idea.
Pardee was already back in the saddle and galloping away, not wanting to miss the charge against the Yankees.
Evans then began moving fast. He ordered out skirmishers, but kept the bulk of his troops well hidden. He didn't want the Yankees to know just how few men he really had and just how vulnerable he was. Then the Union troops came in a rush. Evans committed more of his rebels, and they caught the Union troops in a blister of fire, pinning them down. The Yankee commander started shifting troops around, somehow realizing how thin the rebels' lines were. Just as the Union commanders were about to order a charge, the Marauders and Wheat's Louisianans descended on them. Federal troops must have thought somebody opened the gates to hell. On one side, there were some 200-odd gray-shirted and black-trousered men on horseback, screaming as they charged them. A horrible-looking black flag with a ghastly white skull and crossbones against the black, flapping in the wind. The mounted charge was being led by a black-shirted man who held the reins in his teeth, both hands filled with pistols. On the other side, there came what appeared to be a sea of red-shirted soldiers, led by a huge man with a pistol in one hand and a bowie knife in the other. Wheat and his men charged down the hill, straight into the startled Union troops. Jamie emptied both pistols, holstered them, and grabbed for the two on the left and right of his saddle and began firing. He charged Satan into the sea of blue, and the big horse knocked men spinning in all directions.
Fall back!
Fall back!
Jamie and Wheat's men retreated, having created chaos and confusion, giving Beauregard time to send in reinforcements. The charge was costly for both the Marauders and Wheat's Tigers. In Jamie's unit, 10 men were killed and a dozen wounded. Wheat lost almost 50 men dead and wounded. He was hit hard himself, but he had no intention of dying just yet. He turned over his command to his executive officer and was back on his feet in a month, once more leading the Tigers into battle. The Union forces took the greatest casualties. Several hundred blue-shirted troops lay dead or wounded. The combined actions had bought a little time for Evans, but after assessing the situation, Evans decided it was time for a major pullback. He had received word that another Yankee column was crossing the bridge at Sudley Ford. Just then, two Confederate brigades came running and riding up, bringing with them much-needed artillery. Jamie swung up into the saddle.
Marauders, we're out of here. Follow me.
Units from Alabama and Mississippi, under the command of General B, and units from Georgia, under the command of Colonel Bartow, formed a line facing the Yankees, some of the rebels as close as 50 yards from the Union troops. There were approximately 5,000 rebels facing some 15,000 Federal troops. Even though, or probably because, they were outnumbered at least 3-1, the rebels charged the Yankee line. The bold move surprising the hell out of the Union command. General B's troops quickly pulled out in front of the rest of the rebels, leaving both flanks badly exposed. B ordered Evans and Bartow back and withdrew to Young's Branch. Jamie sat on a bridge not far away and watched the action through field glasses while his men rested behind him. He could see no reasonable course of action for his men to take. Just as he was rising to his feet, a runner from headquarters reached his side.
Orders from General Beauregard, sir. You are asked to take your men up to the Warrenton Turnpike and try to prevent Burnside's troops from flanking Evans.
Is that right?
What'd you say, boys? Less than 200 lightly armed men against 5,000?
Yeah! Tell General Beauregard we ride at once, son.